Ezekiel chapter 5. All right, I'm going to do it. I'll do it. I'll just read. We're going to do 5 and 6, by the way, just so you know. They're short, and they're semi-repetitive. So once you get a little bit of the versage, you'll figure out what the meaning, you know, what he's trying to say. But Ezekiel chapter 5, I will read the chapter in its entirety without commentary. I know. Hold your breath. You ready? Yeah. Now, son of man, take a sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor to shave your head and your beard. Then take a set of scales and divide up the hair. When the days of your siege come to an end, burn a third of the hair with fire inside the city. Take a third and strike it with the sword all around the city. Scatter a third to the wind. For I will pursue them with drawn sword. But take a few strands of your hair and tuck them away in the folds of your garment. Again, take a few of these and throw them into the fire and burn them up. Fire will spread from there to the whole house of Israel. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations, with countries all around her. Yet in her wickedness she has rebelled against my laws and decrees more than the nations and countries around her. She has rejected my laws and has not followed my decrees. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. You have been more unruly than the nations around you and have not followed my decrees or kept my laws. You have not even conformed to the standards of the nations around you. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I myself am against you, Jerusalem, and I will inflict punishment on you in the sight of the nations. Because of your detestable idols, I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again. Therefore, in your midst, fathers will eat their children, and children will eat their fathers. I will inflict punishment on you and will scatter all your survivors to the winds. Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Lord, Sovereign Lord, because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your vile images and detestable practices, I myself will withdraw my favor. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. A third of your people will die of the plague or perish by famine inside you. A third will fall by the sword outside your walls, and a third will scatter to the winds and pursue with drawn sword. And then my anger will cease, and my wrath against them will subside, and I will be avenged. And when I have spent my wrath upon them, they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal. I will make you a ruin and a reproach among the nations around you, in the sight of all who pass by. You will be a reproach and a taunt, a warning and an object of horror to the nations around you when I inflict punishment on you in anger and in wrath and with stinging rebuke. I, the Lord, have spoken. When I shoot at you with my deadly and destructive arrows of famine, I will shoot to destroy you. I will bring more and more famine upon you and cut off your food supply. I will send famine and wild beasts among you, and they will leave you childless. Plague and bloodshed will sweep through you, and I will bring the sword against you. I, the Lord, have spoken. Y'all feeling good? Yeah. Where's the gospel? I love it. You know what? I have to admit something. Ezekiel is really tough. If you think this is the end of it, this isn't the end of it. We haven't even got chapter 6, or 7, or 8, or 9, or 10, or 11, or 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, or 24. All of those chapters are spoken against the people inside Jerusalem, part of the covenant relationship with God. 24 beautiful, blessed chapters we'll be covering. After that, we'll get a little bit of a reprieve. Chapter 25 through 48, we get promises of destruction of the nations around them and a return of the remnant, a return of the exiles. That sounds a little more positive, but what do we do about these first 24 chapters? I say we chuck them. Why study them? I mean, honestly, do you guys enjoy this stuff? Because I know I don't. I talk to people about this material, and they say things about the Old Testament. They say the Old Testament is irrelevant. The Old Testament portrays a God of anger. It portrays something that we don't see in Jesus Christ. How can God be so upset? And we're reading this stuff, and it sounds like God is a little angry, doesn't it? And that doesn't preach very well. It really doesn't. So I'm just going to let you know you don't have to listen to any of this stuff. God doesn't really care. Because isn't that what we really want? I think we all want a God that doesn't care. Yes, we do. We really do. There's people that come to me for advice. I love it. They come to me and say, well, what should we do? I mean, here's a situation, and what do you think? Is this stealing or is this not stealing? Is this gossiping or is this not gossiping? Is this not being a good parent or is this being a good parent? Is this being a good spouse or is this not being a good spouse? And they come to me for advice. And then I say, well, let me pray, let me study, let me see what Scripture says. And then I come back and I say, sometimes, very difficultly, what you are doing is wrong. And that's a hard thing to say. Please don't. I don't like doing that. But I come back and I say, it's wrong. And you know what a lot of people like to do with that? They go, I'll just do it anyway. It doesn't matter. I mean, isn't God a God of love and mercy and compassion? I mean, that doesn't seem to jive here with this wonderful explanation here in Ezekiel chapter 5. And I know sometimes we say, gosh, can't we just have God let me do what I want? Can't I just do what I want, live under God's grace? Yeah. Well, that's what most kids think, sure, yeah. Can't you just be nice to me? Why do you have to punish me? Why do you have to discipline me? Don't you love me? Let me tell you something very important. God is an angry God. That's a hard thing to say, because we don't like to talk about Him getting angry. It is in His anger that He shows His love. Married people, imagine this. Your spouse comes home and says to you, I've just had an affair on you. I just went out and cheated on you. What do you think the proper response should be when you find out that someone's been unfaithful? Oh, it's no big deal. Oh, you went out and had an affair. Oh, well, I don't care. Okay, straw, yeah. It's no big deal. Yeah, you had an affair. Yeah, what goes around, okay, what comes around goes around. Yeah. The proper response that we all have in that type of situation is what? We get angry. If you commit adultery and then you go to your spouse and they say they don't care, they're also saying something else. They don't love you. They don't love you. I mean, that's the clearest message you could send to someone. Oh, you cheated on me? Oh, well. That says, I really don't love you because I really don't care. But it's in the anger that says this is important. Now, it's funny because I do talk to a lot of people about adultery. And it's interesting when I ask couples, women especially, of what would you do if your husband came and told you this, prior to any, if there was no adultery. But I said, what would happen if your husband came and said that? And almost every female has the exact same reaction. Well, I'd leave him like that. He's gone. He's out. He's done. It's fascinating. Very interesting. Because then I compare that to the actual cases I've encountered with adultery happening with spouses. And one very telling one, when she said, in the past, I would have said I would have dumped him like a hot rock. But, this is her words, I cannot turn off my love for him like I'm turning off a faucet. Wow. Was she angry? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I cleared the desk, No sharp objects, Nothing that you could throw and hit someone, Yeah. She was angry. Oh, by all means. Oh, very angry. But isn't it interesting that it's in the anger that the love is shown? Because if the spouse did not get angry, then they really wouldn't care. You don't want, listen to this, you do not want a God that doesn't care. I know sometimes we feel that way because we love our sin so much. We say to ourselves, gosh, I love doing what I'm doing, and I would much rather just say God is gracious and compassionate. He really does it. I know that deep down we really want to believe that, but you don't. Trust me, you do not want a God that doesn't care. Because if He doesn't care, He doesn't love. That's what's happening. Ezekiel, you got to get the picture. Now, Ezekiel, remember, he's not allowed to speak unless God literally opens his mouth and his tongue starts flapping. God says, I'm going to make your tongue stick to the roof of your mouth. And later on, he'll actually say, there comes a time when it gets released and he can speak freely. Up until that point, every word that comes out of his mouth is literally, directly a word of God coming through that. And then he was told the wonderful thing last week that we looked at, You're going to have to be on your left side for 390 days. Again, please don't miss the significance. 390 days, that's over a year. Now, I think maybe you and I would probably get bored after a week of looking at this guy. You know, you were like coming out, you're like, hey, what's up with Ezekiel today? Is he still eating that whacked out bread and drinking the really small amount of water and laying siege to the the fake city that he set up? Is he still doing? And you walk out and you look and, hey, still on his left side. He's still eating the nasty bread. And it is nasty. I don't care what you say. I took it home to my dog and the dog wouldn't eat the bread. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't do that. Nasty bread. My sister still, she said she was going to turn it into the Thanksgiving stuffing. Maybe if it was doused with gravy and butter, maybe it would be edible. Anyway, so there's Ezekiel. He's laying on his side, and 390 days, that's over a year. I mean, you would come out, you're like, oh, there he is, on his left side. Now again, I could imagine on day 391, that must have been a cool day. Because of what happened on day 391? He switched sides. He flipped over, right? That's it. He flipped over onto his right side. And he still is keeping his attack going on the city, eating the nasty bread, drinking a little bit of water. And he's but imagine, you know, you come out and you're looking at Ezekiel and he stands up. You'd be like, you know, and I don't know, was there a crowd gathered? I like to think that maybe a crowd gathered every now and again to see the weird prophet. And he's standing up. Oh my gosh, can you believe this? He's standing up. And he's getting back down on his side. Is that it? Is that the show? I don't know. I would probably watch it for maybe 10 minutes, you know. Is he going to move? No, he's just eating that nasty bread. Drinking the water. Let's see if something happens tomorrow. And then you come out, I don't know, maybe after a week again, I'd be bored. You'd be walking by this guy because he's there on his right side for 40 days. 40 days, over a month. Then, on day 431, he stands up. I don't know if maybe his legs were in atrophy by that time or what, but he gets up. So again, I don't want you to miss, from chapter 4 to chapter 5 is a long period of time. And later on, Ezekiel is going to give us a time marker, and sure enough, there is plenty of time for all this to take place, sparing even an extra month in there when you calculate it out. So this did happen. He was out there. He wasn't out there for figurative 430 days. He was on his side. Left side for 390, right side for 40 days. On day 431, he stands up and asks for a sword. I don't know who gave him the sword. A sword in the hands of a weird prophet is not a good thing. That's when he does this. I'm going to go back over this material. Son of man, take a sharp sword. I'm back on chapter 5 if you didn't know. Chapter 5, verse 1. Back there. Sorry. Yes. Stay with me. Take the sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor to shave your head and your beard. Now, that's not a good thing. Shaving your head and beard as a Jewish person is not a good thing. Now, I know we have the images all messed up. We got David and Goliath, right? What are the images you get when you see David and Goliath? You got David. He's big. He's tall. He's hairy, right? He usually has no shirt on. He's got big pectoral muscles. But, I mean, hair is sprouting out everywhere. He's got hair all over his head. And what color is the hair always? Oh, I always see it as red. Yeah, I always see red-haired Goliath, because redheads are just... Yeah, Goliath. Oh, did I say David? I'm sorry. Goliath. I always see redheads, because redheads are... Oh, sorry. Redheads are so wonderful, Stephanie. They're just so nice and so wonderful. But I don't know, they always portray Goliath as having red hair. And he's got a lot of it. He's got beard and scraggly, and he's got food and small children tucked away in there, and he's just on there. And then you got David, right? And how big is David? He's usually about what, this high, right? He's down on the ground somewhere. He's just, you know, he takes out his baby bottle and says, "I come against you with the word of God," right? And David is always the same. He's clean shaven. He's got a nice haircut. He's usually blonde haired, blue eyed. Yeah, right. Jewish, got to have a big nose, black hair. Come on, there's nothing wrong with it. But it's always funny because he's always clean shaven, like he's this cute little boy. Well, again, David was not a little boy, okay? He was 18. He'd already killed lions with his bare hands. Does that sound like a wimp to you? No, this dude was buff. This dude had it going on. And if he was Jewish, he was hairy. Goliath, the Philistine, was the clean shaven one. For a Jewish person to be shaved... is horrible. You know, look at now, especially the real strict, the Hasidic Jews. You see pictures of them at the Wailing Wall, right? What do you see? You always see the big long beards. You see the very long sideburns because they're not allowed to trim their sideburns. And some of you are thinking, gosh, I want to be Jewish. That would be cool to have all that long hair all over the place. That's how they're supposed to be. So Ezekiel gets up, grabs the sword, and starts cutting. That's humiliating for an Israelite. This happened also in 2 Samuel. David has sent a group of people he's doing some conquest, and he sends a group of people to this other country, and he's trying to make a peace negotiation, like, you know, hey, let's work together, or, you know, pay me tribute, I won't kill you type thing. And so he sends this group in good faith, and this dude named Hanun, he sees David's men, shaved off half of each man's beard, cut off the garments in the middle at the buttocks, so that their little boxes with little hearts were showing, and sent them away. When David was told about this, he sent messengers to meet the men, for they were greatly humiliated. The king said, stay at Jericho till your beards have grown, and then come back. The idea of having your beard and your head shaven was humiliating, and that was not something that was good. So Ezekiel is now doing something he probably does not want to do. And as he's doing this, again, it's becoming prophetic. Is this the only time God has ever spoken to the Israelite nation that he's going to cut them off? No. Well, you might be asking, where in the Bible else does it? Was there any previous prophecy? Well, I'm so glad you asked. Book of Isaiah. I don't think you can miss this one, can you? In that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs. They didn't use, you know, Nair or Neat or anything like that. They shaved them. And to take off your beards also. God had already told them, I'm going to do this. And now Ezekiel, again, this is only a couple of years before the siege is going to happen. This is a couple of years prior to 586, before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple is going to take place, before the invasion is going to happen, before the siege is taking place. And even then, God is so patient. I mean, wouldn't you at that, why wait till 586? Why not just send them in now? Just get it over with. I mean, you come to me and you say, I've been cheating on my wife. And what happens if I let it go for 7 years? Be like, are you crazy? But do you see, this is God at his most patient. Seeing all this, and you're going to see it. He actually goes through it. If you want to peek ahead, you can. Ezekiel chapter 8. Idolatry in the temple. Ezekiel gets literally picked up by the hair, dragged over to the temple, and gets to see into the secret chambers. And what were the priests doing inside those secret chambers that no one else could see? Not good stuff. And God is still being patient. And he's supposed to take this hair, and he divides them up into three piles, right? One pile he takes and he puts it into this little imaginary thing and he burns it. Then he takes another and he spreads it around the city with a sword, and then he starts chopping at that hair. I mean, this is pretty dramatic. Do you think they're getting the picture? And then he takes it into the other clump of hair, and he takes it and he tosses it up into the air, and the wind just whoosh, sweeps it away. Well, what do you think? What do you think that means? Well, we already read it, so you hopefully you should have figured out without the description. God said, a third of you are going to die in the city, a third of you are going to die outside the city, presumably trying to escape, and a third of you are going to go into exile. And you'll probably die there too. Not good news, is it? But I want a nice God. I want a loving God. I want a God that doesn't care. No, you don't. No, you don't. There comes a point when you need to take a look at your life and wonder, what am I supposed to be doing? Dan, thank you so much for asking where's the gospel in this, because, yeah, is there any good news in this whole thing? You might have missed it. No, I didn't. Oh, yeah, well, that's part of the gospel. But what was there was something else. You got a third of hair here, a third of hair here, and a third of hair here, and then, yeah, he takes this little group. I don't know how many hairs, but he takes a couple, and he tucks them into the fold of his garment. Again, for a Jewish person, they would have a long garment, they'd have a sash, kind of like a belt, and they do what we do, you know, we kind of pull it out and maybe tuck it over, and it turns into, you know, it kind of makes little pockets, right? So, you know, you put their flashlight, their iPod, cell phone, right? They can store all that. It's like the Jewish fanny pack, okay? That's what it's kind of like. That's how we would understand. So he's supposed to take some of these hairs, and he's supposed to tuck them away. Wow. You mean God won't destroy them completely? No, he won't. He won't, because he made a promise. He made a promise that whenever things got bad, he would never completely destroy. Ever. Where's that from? Leviticus 26. Do you remember Leviticus 26 last week? If you weren't here last week, you don't remember. But last week we talked about Leviticus 26. Read it. And it's this whole long chapter of, if you keep messing up, I'm going to bring this against you. And if you still don't get the message, I'm going to bring this against you. And if you still don't get the message, and it goes on for like 44 verses. Finally, we get here to the end of Leviticus 26. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or abhor them so as to destroy them completely, breaking my covenant with them. I am the Lord their God. But for their sake, I will remember the covenant with their ancestors who I brought out of Egypt in the sight of the nations to be their God. I am the Lord. He also said in the book of Malachi, I, the Lord, do not change. So you, O descendants of Jacob, are not destroyed. Theologians like to call this remnant theology. It's beautiful theology. It means that there's always a point where God's going to stop because he will never destroy completely. Where does it show up in the Old Testament? Lots of places. Noah's Ark. I mean, the whole world is going to heck in a handbasket really fast. And God says, that's it, I'm done. I'm taking them out. Except for 8 people. Now imagine, 8 people. What is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Like this section right here. 8 out of the entire world. Completely destroyed. These guys saved. God will not destroy completely. Sodom and Gomorrah. Was Sodom and Gomorrah utterly destroyed? Was it completely destroyed? Was every inhabitant of Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed? No. There's a couple that got saved. Right? Abraham's making the haggling with God, right? And these two angels get sent into Sodom and Gomorrah. And you're like, why are the two angels going in there? Well, Abraham gets this haggling thing with God, and God says, I'm going to destroy the city. And Abraham says, you can't destroy the city. I mean, what if there's like 50 righteous people in that city? You going to kill them then? God says, for 50 people, I'll spare the city. How about 40? Okay, for 40 people, I won't destroy the city. I don't mean to be, you know, pushing the boundaries or anything. How about 35? 35 people? 35? 30. 30. Do I hear 25, 25, 25, 25? Haggles them down. Finally, we get the idea that there's not that many righteous people left in Sodom and Gomorrah, but there were some that needed to be saved. And the cities were not destroyed until they got out. Lot, his daughters, wife almost made it. She was assaulted. Sorry. Remnant theology. Remnant theology. How does this work for us? God will never destroy you completely. There might be things that come in your life that are really bad. And you need to ask yourself, you know, what's going on? What's happening? Even if things aren't happening bad in your life, now's a good time to say, what am I doing with my life? Am I getting lackadaisical with sin? Am I thinking to myself, sin's not too bad. Not that big of a deal. I think I'll do it anyway. No big deal, right? Doesn't God forgive me? Doesn't God love me? God doesn't care, right? No. God cares. Your friends are all asking the same question. Don't you preach a God of love? Don't you preach a God that, you know, doesn't really care about what we do with our lives? No, 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 God cares. Sometimes things happen in life. You may feel like you're being destroyed. Remember the promise of Isaiah. A bruised reed he will not break. A smoldering wick he will not put out. Sometimes when we get to the end, we look back and we see, wow, God was through that whole thing. He might have been destroying a lot of me, but he never destroyed me completely. And you're going to have a choice. There's going to be two responses that you can have at this. You can either say, I don't like this God, and I'm out of here. Because a lot of people did that. A lot of the Jewish remnant, as they got scattered, a lot of them said, wow, God's not that nice. I don't think I like him anymore. I'm gone. But some said, what were we doing? How did we get this far? And they humbly sit back and look at their sin and they say, I'm sorry. That'll be the same for you. You'll be confronted with your sin, and you're going to do one of two things. You're either going to say, no, it's not that big of a deal. Who cares? Or you're going to look at it and go, I can't believe God didn't destroy me earlier. Why was he so gracious? Why was he so merciful? Because all through it, there's another chance. And another chance. Hairs tucked away. God's promise will not destroy you completely. But he wants to get your attention. What are you going to do with your life? All right. So he says that all this stuff is going to happen, and it did. It was horrible. I know you didn't like verse 10, but it happened. If you want an encore presentation, you just have to go to 70 AD. We have it spelt out in graphic detail. Another destruction of Jerusalem, another judgment of God, and it was horrendous. Fathers eating children, children eating fathers. There were fights breaking out amongst families. Which child should we eat first? Let's eat yours first. Then we'll eat mine. Whoa. It was bad. You got to understand the siege rules. The siege wasn't you didn't come in and, you know, bomb them with bombers. They didn't have any. They didn't come in with the armored tanks and blow down the wall. They surrounded it. And they waited. And they cut off supplies. They cut off the water supply. They cut off the food supply. And they sit. And they sit and they sit. And usually, in a case like this, your best chance to survive is to attack early. Your best chance, if you are inside the city, is to say, let's go out now. Because this is our only shot. But if you decided, no, let's wait. Let's see if we can hold out. That invading army, being strong enough, will surround you, cut off your food supply so you can't eat. Well, who's going to defend the city now? Now what happens if you come out? Food got so scarce, they ate lots of stuff. And they drank lots of stuff. And they went crazy. Literally, they went crazy. They went insane. They were trapped. Happened the same thing again in 70 AD. That's why when you read the book of Revelation, absolutely incredible. The judgment when it's, wow, the cutting off. That's what's happening. These people, and God says, you've got to get out now. You've got to change now. This is the time to do it. So there he's chopping up hairs and lighting them on the fire. Chapter 6. Prophecy against the mountains of Israel. Word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against the mountains of Israel. Prophesy against them and say, Oh, mountains of Israel. I'm sorry, did anyone get tripped up on that like I did? You want me to go what? Talk to a mountain? You want me to... Now, one commentator, I thought it was kind of funny, said that possibly the mountains would be a little more receptive than the people. The mountains would probably listen better. I don't know if that's actually true. It's more than likely the fact that the prophecy is to speak to the mountains and other people are going to hear you talking. This was a pride issue. The mountains were the pride of the Jews. When they came into the promised land, right, they went in and they were told that, you know, take this part, this part, this part, this part. You know where they usually settled at? They look down in the plain and they're like, wow, I don't know if we can get that and see people, all those Philistines, you know, with their red hair. I don't know if we can attack them. You know what? No one's in the foothills. No one's here in the mountains. We feel comfortable in the mountains. We're shepherds. We're sheep people. We're not really farmers. Well, we can do that if we had to, but we'd much rather just raise sheep. So being up in the foothills of the mountain, much easier, much better. I think we'll stay up here. And this was how they operated. They operated so much that other cultures started recognizing this too. A man of God came up and told the king of Israel, this is what the Lord says, because the Arameans think the Lord is the God of the hills and not the God of the valleys, I'll deliver this vast army in your hands. The big thing to notice is the Arameans said the Jewish God, the God of Israel, was a mountain god. So if you can get them out on the plains, you can wipe them out. Well, lo and behold, they found out that wherever the Israelites went, God was with them. But that's how they operated. They loved the mountains and the hills. This was a pride. So when Ezekiel is told to go and speak against the mountains of Israel, this is to speak against the pride. What you're most proud of? Son of man, go and speak to the Hollywood sign. Son of man, go and speak to the financial district on Wall Street. Son of man! Go and speak to the Empire State Building. That's the idea. He's going to go and speak to the mountains. Now, it is true. It happened two more times, just so you know. Because I did a search. I'm like, where, did other people get the weird, you know, thing of preaching to mountains or inanimate objects? Well, Ezekiel does it two more times, just so you know. Ezekiel 35, Son of man, set your face against Mount Seir, prophesy against it, and then in chapter 36, Son of man, prophesy the mountains of Israel and say, oh, mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. And so he speaks to them twice. There's only one other that I could find. Now, again, I didn't do an exhaustive search, but I did find one guy preaching to an altar. That was kind of funny. He said, God said, go speak to the altar and tell the altar that's going to be broken in half and ashes are scattered around it. Well, the idea was, as he was speaking to the altar, the people around them were listening. And one guy got so upset, he's all, you will not! And just as he stuck out his hand, it shriveled. Is that cool or what? Don't tell me the Bible's boring, people. Man. Anyway, so he's going to go speak to the mountains. Again, the idea is that the people are going to listen. This is the pride issues. This is what's holding them back. This is what they believe their strength is in. And their strength isn't supposed to be in the mountains. I lift my eyes up from the hill. Where does my help come from? It comes from the Lord. O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord, sovereign Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm in the middle of verse 3, right? Yeah. This is what the sovereign Lord says. To the mountains and the hills, the ravines and the valleys, I am about to bring a sword against you, and I will destroy your high places. That's a key thing. High places, that's code for bad altars. High places were up in the mountains, were areas where they originally set it up as worship to God, to Yahweh. But as time went on, they started getting a little corrupt. And so the high places turned into other locations. When you read 1 2 Samuel, 1 2 Kings, 1 2 Chronicles, you read that and it talks about how a reform took place. And they went around and destroyed the high places. You're like, what is that? Destroyed. That's what they're talking about. The high places were where these altars were set up. So he's up now in the mountains and he's also effectively preaching to these high places. God says, I'm going to tear them down. I'm going to tear them down. I'm about to bring a sword against you and destroy your high places. Verse 4, your altars will be demolished and your incense altars will be smashed. I don't know if you care about this kind of stuff. I get a big kick out of it. The original Hebrew is actually a slam against the incense altars. Alternate translation. You ready? Sheep. You can write this down. You ready? Sheep. Doo-doo. D-O-D-O. Or is it? There are two O's. D-O-O-D-O. Yeah. Dung pellets could be another translation of this. So there's a shot being taken of what God thinks of false gods. Yeah. I can tell you really didn't care. I'll move on. Your altars will be demolished and your incense altars will be smashed, and I will slay your people in front of your idols. I will lay the dead bodies of the Israelites in front of your idols. I will scatter your bones around your altars. Wherever you live, the towns will be laid waste and the high places demolished so that your altars will be laid waste and devastated, your idols smashed and ruined, your incense altars broken down, and when you have been wiped out, and what you have made wiped out, your people will fall slain among you, and you will know that I am the Lord your God. Again, that doesn't sound very nice. I want a nice God. I want a pleasant God. No, you don't. You want an angry God. Why is he so angry? Why did I bring up adultery as my example at the beginning? It wasn't my idea. It was God's. Look at what he says. Verse 8. But I will spare some. For some of you will escape the sword when you are scattered among the lands and nations. Then in the nations where they have been carried captive, those who escape will remember me, how I have been grieved. Gosh, it sounds so weak. God's devastated. When we go chasing after other things, oh, grieved. He's devastated. It hurts him to the core. How I have been grieved by their adulterous hearts, which have turned away from me, and by their eyes, which have lusted after their idols. They will loathe themselves for the evil they have done, and for all their detestable practices. And they will know that I am the Lord. I did not threaten in vain to bring this calamity on them. Someone emailed me. I said that word calamity stuck out as like hitting a pebble on a skateboard. I stopped. Calamity. Do we ever use that word calamity anymore? Well, except if we're talking about Jane. You know, we got calamity. that sounds kind of weak too, right? So sure enough, this guy, who's a total layman, but he has an inner linear, so he went back and he wanted to check, is it right? He says, is this Ra? And you look up the word Ra, and what do you get? You get evil, you get destruction, you get total annihilation, you get devastation. And then I guess another translation is calamity. It's not a calamity. This is big. God is coming against them. Why? Because he loves them. Because he needs them to wake up. He needs them to see that you need to be sickened by your sin, just so you know. I'll come out and say it. You should look at your sin and go, I can't believe this. What have I done? And then you say, Lord, please. And what happens to these people? These are the ones, they're the tucked away ones. They're the remnant. They're the ones that God spares. The one that God again pours out. Again, this idea of pouring out wrath, it didn't satisfy God. He finally got satisfied when? When his wrath was poured out on one person. Wow, God was angry. But he does it because he loves. What are we supposed to do? Look at ourselves. We say, God, man, we've messed up. This is not easy, I know. This is not milk. I know. I've been chewing on this for an entire week going, wow. I've been chewing on turkey legs too, but as I was chewing on turkey legs, I was thinking about this material. This is not easy. This is tough stuff. But now you know why God in this Old Testament era is always upset, it seems like. It's because he loves his people. And did you catch the idea that these people were doing things that even the nations weren't the nations had set up standards, and the Israelites were worse than that. The Israelites were worse than Sodom and Gomorrah? Whoa. That would be like me preaching to you that it's okay to have sex with a minor. Wouldn't that be the... I mean, society has said that is wrong. We cannot do that. There's punishment for it. Imagine a church saying, oh, that's okay. Because I want a God that's nice, and a God that doesn't care, and a God that lets me do... Their standards were nowhere near. We need to stop and say, what is wrong? And ask for forgiveness. And I promise you, he does forgive. He always does. He always has. He always will. He always holds those treasured few, no matter how few they are or how many in number they are. He will always hold you in your hand, in his hands. But he wants you to change. It's important. Verse 11, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, strike your hands together and stamp your feet and cry out, alas, because of all the wicked and detestable practices of the house of Israel. For they will fall by the sword, famine, and plague. He that is far away will die of the plague. He that is near will fall by the sword. And he that survives the spared will die of famine. So will I spent my wrath on them. And they will know that I am the Lord when their people lie slain among their idols, around their altars, on every high hill and on their mountaintops, under every spreading tree and every leafy oak, places where they offered fragrant incense to all their idols. And I will stretch out my hand against them and make the land a desolate waste from the desert to Diblah, wherever they live. And they will know that I am the Lord. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do with this material? It's very simple. I mean, it's so easy. You could just leave here and go, wow, I sure hope next week is a little bit better. When are we going to get to another gospel? Isn't it turn to go to a gospel? When are we going to back in the New Testament? Or you can stop and say, what do I need to change now? What is God calling me to change? And if you have been destroyed by your sin, and I know a lot of us are, I get it. I also get those people that come to me and they say, I've messed up. Oh my gosh, I can't believe what I've done. You won't believe it. Of course, I always believe it because I always hear it. I believe it. You did it. And they come and they say, I can't believe I'm so sorry. I've messed up. Smoldering wick will not put out, and a bruised reed he will not break. And he will look at you and say, you are forgiven. That's where we're supposed to be. Let's pray. God, this is tough, Lord. Wow. I know I've done it, Lord. I like to preach the nice parts, Lord. Because I want people to have a break, but maybe I've taken that too far. Maybe instead I've condone sin or... Man. So, Lord, I don't know where people are at right now. Maybe some people here are already broken, because that happens. We look at our sin and we go, we're disgusted. That was just wrong. Some of us might be sitting here going, it's not too bad. It's not that big of a deal. So you're going to have to speak to their hearts and what's going on in their lives. And you're going to have to reveal yourself to them, and you're going to have to get your message deep in their heart. And if they need to change, Lord, help them to change. Maybe an Ezekiel needs to come in their life. Maybe someone needs to have a graphic demonstration. Or maybe they just need to look at the most graphic demonstration of all and what Christ did for us. And Lord, if they're broken, if they're bruised, if their wick is almost out, and they have dropped to their knees and said, Lord, I've messed up, help them to take refuge in you. Help them to look up, not in the things that other people say that can save them. Help them to look higher, to lift their eyes up to the Lord, and take refuge in what you have. Lord, grow us. This is a time of growth for us. We're growing up mature-wise in our faith when we read and understand this material. And help that to never stop. And help us then to go and shout to the north and the south and the east and the west that you are so good, and yet you are so just. And maybe we can even drop some PC phrases, Lord, like righteous indignation, and just say it like it is. Sometimes you get angry. You get angry at our sin. Thank you that you care about us that much. That it is something that is so important to you, for it is important to us. Speak to us now, Lord.